Willis Osbakken is a lifelong Sitka resident whose family goes back to Russian days. In this interview, recorded in November of 2012, he shares stories about growing up in Sitka, adventures with his uncle Bill Hamlin, about his father, who came to America as a ship's carpenter apprentice on a square-rigged ship. He tells about his Alaska Native Russian ancestors who worked for the Russian-American Company, Silver Bay Mining, the Salmon in Swan Creek, and playing on the Crescent.
Okay, I'm a lifelong Sitkan. I was born here in Sitka in November of 1936 and went to all my grade school, high school here in Sitka. Went to college at the Washington State University. And after that, returned to Sitka and have been here ever since. My dad was born in Norway, Mosjøen, Norway, in 1882, which would make, on November 1st, so on November 1st, he would have been 130 years old,
and, wow,
which is quite a ways back for one generation. And he left Norway just before the turn of that century and sailed around the world several times on square riggers as a carpenter's apprentice, and eventually disembarked in San Francisco. And the ship that he was working on at the time is still in San Francisco. It's the Belle Clutha, which is the centerpiece of the National Park Service Marine Park there in San Francisco. So it's kind of neat that the ship is still there. And then he worked for a number of years on railroad construction, drilling tunnels, that sort of stuff, and eventually came up to Alaska, I'm sad to say, in the bootlegging business, but hey, it's part of history, right?
So when did he make it to Sitka?
In the 1920s, I believe, and he was a fisherman also. He went to Myers Chuck first, then to Port Alexander, and eventually to Sitka, and had a little troller and fished out of here.
So when he was mining and working on railroads, that was in the Northwest?
In Colorado and in the Northwest, I think. I don't know if you ever knew of Hugo Fredrickson, but Hugo Fredrickson one time told me he worked with my dad in Colorado in 1902 on a tunnel, you know, for a railroad.
So was he a laborer? Or?
Yes, he was a driller. They drilled with hand steels back then, hammer and steel, you know.
So they would drill a hole for the powder?
Yeah, to blast the tunnel, you know. Nowadays they use big drill rigs for doing that, but back then it was all by hand.
So was it a big screw drill that they would pound in?
It was a steel with a bit on the end, and you turned it with one hand and hit it with a hammer in the other, or if there was multiple people, you had one guy turning the steel and several people striking it with hammers. And the guy that was turning the steel was in a precarious position, I think. With these guys. But my dad said you got so used to swinging the hammer you never missed. He said it just was almost became second nature. You know, you could, very rare that someone would miss the steel with the hammer.
So, but that might have led to his looking for something a little different to do.
Possibly, I guess. He was always into different ventures, you know. When he got to Sitka, after he settled down here, he started with another Norwegian. They had the Anchor Bar downtown, right where the bank next to Wells Fargo is. I don't remember the name of the bank, but the Anchor Bar was located right in that area, and had that for a number of years. And then when he sold it, and also right after the war, he and his partner bought a large vessel called the Point Reyes that they used for packing fish and buying fish and hauling freight and, you know, all sorts of adventures like that. And as a young teenager, and before that even, I grew up working on his boats, you know, and my brother and I both worked on the Point Reyes and buying fish and backpacking fish and stuff.
What company was he buying for?
Booth Fisheries and others. I couldn't actually say. He bought, when we were buying, we'd go out for a week at a time, and we'd go like to Cass Bay, and we'd anchor there and buy right from the fishermen, carried cash, paid him cash. So he had about $10,000 worth of cash aboard, you know.
Was that a problem? I mean,
I don't know. He always had a 45 semi-automatic or Army Colt, you know, that he just in case. But we never had any problems.
So that was after the bar business?
No, that was during. That was still during. Sometimes he would run the bar, and sometimes his partner would. And then a third person bought into the bar named Al Spear, and Al Spear was running the bar most of the time, and my dad and Louis Johansson were doing their boat stuff.
So was Louis Johansson the other partner in the bar?
He was the Norwegian partner that my dad partnered up with. Louis lived at Goddard Hot Springs, and he had a boathouse there and a little boat of his own. And one time they they bought a seiner, and they were into seining, and it was kind of neat for my brother and I, because we'd go down to Goddard in the summertime sometimes while they were working on their nets and their seine skiffs and things, and we'd spend like 2 weeks at a time down there, and it was just a great place to be as kids, you know. We had our own little skiff there, and we could just go out and fool around all day long in it.
So how old would you have been? That was...
I was probably 12, 13, 14 years old, somewhere in there, yeah.
So how would you get down there? You'd get a ride with?
Well, we'd go down on my dad's boat, but they were always, they built their own skiffs, and they built, you know, and worked on their nets and things. And in that big boathouse there that Louis had, the herring seiners used to hang there. There was only one herring fisherman here at the time that I knew of, was a fellow named Tom Elswick. And he had a boat called the Yellowstone. And he would store his nets in that big boathouse of Louis. And so it was just, they were all hanging from the ceiling to the floor and just curtains of them. And it was a fun place to play, you know. You could go in there and play hide and seek and just all kinds of neat stuff. And so it was one of those fond memories of growing up, you know, in that era.
So did you explore a lot, like around the islands?
Oh, yeah, all the time. And then sometimes friends of ours would come down there and either they were on somebody else's boat and fishing and stuff, but they'd sometimes stay with us and we'd get to pal around down there with them too. So it was a fun thing.
So would you stay in Louis Johansson's house? Is that... Because I know Cabot Christensen has a place down there.
I think that was the house. Warren Christensen bought the house from Louis. The boathouse fell down. But the house was still standing the last time I was down there, which has been quite a few years now. Yeah.
So the boathouse, was it floating or on
no,
the
no,
land?
No, it was on pilings. And it was quite large. My dad told me that when Louis first came to Goddard, he built the boathouse first, then he built the boat, and then he built his own house. So, but he had to have the boat for his livelihood, you know, fishing. Yeah.
So had he...
He was here already when my dad got here. Yeah.
But he was from Norway?
Yeah. I grew up in a household that my dad and his friends spoke Norwegian, and my mom and her brothers and sisters spoke Russian, and my brother and I, we ended up speaking only English. It's a sad thing.
So your dad came up to Sitka, and then got involved in the Anchor Bar?
Right.
And then what about Prohibition? Was that before, during, after?
That was when he first got here. That's what he was involved in. He was involved in, he had a Sitka cigar store that he called it, and it was a front for a little bootlegging operation. Some guys were making the alcohol. They had stills out on some of the islands where there'd been fox farms and things. And anyway, he had a cigar store for a front for the bootlegging, and he eventually got caught and had to spend some time in the federal jail up in Skagway.
So he'd be like selling it by the bottle?
I don't know.
Or who knows?
I don't know. Probably selling it by the bottle, I would imagine. I never went into great detail on asking him.
Wow. So how did your parents meet?
I think he met my mom after he became a legitimate businessman. He hired her to work in the liquor store. And eventually they got married, and my brother and I were born. My brother was older. He was 2.5 years older than I am.
So your mother and her friends spoke Russian?
Yeah. Well, my mother was born here. I think I told you that before. She was born here in 1900. Her mother was born here in 1860. And her grandparents, my mother's grandparents, were married here in 1846. And not in the Russian cathedral, but in the old Russian chapel that was here before the cathedral was built, I guess. I think the cathedral was after 1846. And actually, my grandmother's maiden name was Shmakov or Shmakova. That name here in Sitka goes all the way back to the Baranov's time. In one of Richard Pierce's little clips that he sent me once, he said that Alexei Shmakov was put in charge down at Redoubt as in 1818, I think. And of the settlement there. And my mother always used to say her grandfather, whose name was Nikolai Shmakov, not Alexei, was in charge at Redoubt, but I don't see any record of that. It must have been her great-grandfather, I would assume, that Alexei was. But
so you're pretty certain that that was a direct ancestor?
Because of the fact that my mother always said that her grandfather was in charge at Redoubt.
Uh-huh.
And see, but her grandfather died in 1890, 10 years before she was born. And looking back in the records of Redoubt, the Shmakov that was there was like from 1818 to 1825. So I would assume probably the family story just got a little confused on who was in charge. But I couldn't say for absolute certain that Alexei Shmakov is her great-great-grandfather, or her great-grandfather, I mean. My ancestors are what the Russians call Creoles. They were part Native and part Russian. The vital statistics said that Nikolai Shmakov was born in Kodiak, and that would be my great-grandfather. Beyond that, I'm not sure, you know, when they came. Other than that, I know they were here. There were Shmakovs here clear back in Baranov's time. You know.
So would Alexei have possibly been from Russia?
Possibly. I don't know. I really don't know. And Nikolai, I think I mentioned to you, he in 1842, he was one of the five Creoles that Lieutenant Zagoskin hired to go on an expedition of the Yukon and Kuskokwim drainages, and he hired Creoles because he thought they were more civilized, but what he didn't know was that they were city-raised. Probably not as good hunters as full-blood natives would have been. You know, probably would have been better off hiring, I would imagine, if he'd hired Tlinkits or something, they were probably better hunters, you know.
Or people who had been raised subsistence and not buying their food.
Right. So but anyway, his book, Shmakov, is mentioned in there several times, and it's kind of interesting. I have the book. And, so,
in Zagoskin's?
In Zagoskin's book, yeah. At one point, Nikolai Shmakov's feet got frozen, or he got hurt somehow, and he got left behind in a village there, and he really feared for his life because it was, you know, back then was pretty, they weren't always that friendly to newcomers, but he got left behind and then picked up when they came on the way back through there again, you know, but he survived it okay. And that was, you know, and it was after that expedition that he married his bride, who was, his name was Anastasia Semyonov.
And they got married in the predecessor of the St. Michael's.
Yeah, right. And they had about a dozen children, and one of whom was my grandmother, and she was born in 1860 and was a witness to the transfer ceremony on Castle Hill. In her obituary in 1942, when she passed away, why, it said that it was the end of an era. She was the last Russian subject that had been on the hill at the time of the transfer, the last living one.
So she would have been a young child.
7 years old.
But yeah. She remembered it.
She remembered it, yeah. I don't remember talking about it because I was only five when she died, but my mother told me stories that she passed on about witnessing it.
So is there anything that sticks out about that story?
That story, what I remember my mother saying is my grandmother couldn't understand why all the Russian people were crying when they brought down the Russian flag, because she thought the American flag was a lot brighter and more pretty, you know, which is typical of how a seven-year-old would think, I guess. You know? And then when she was a teenager, she went, I'm speaking to my grandmother now, she went to California and worked in a cigar factory. And then she came back, and I think when she was 16, she got married for the first time. Married a merchant that had come here at the time of the transfer, and he was from Prussia, but he had become a U.S. citizen, and he had a bakery.
What was his name?
His name was Frederick William Richter, and she had two children by him. His name was Wasily Richter, but after his father died and my grandmother remarried, he became adopted by John Hanlon, my grandfather, and they changed his name to William Richter Hanlon. And he's quite well known around here as having served as mayor about six times, I think.
And then there's a photo of him in the Centennial Building.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
One of the more distinctive.
Yeah. And he had a brother they called Frederick. And I always thought that he died very young, but according to Bob DeArmond, Fritz was adopted by John Hanlon, and they changed his name to John Hanlon. And in the 1890s, he and three other boys from Sitka were sent to Russia to study to become Russian priests, and he never returned. They heard from him several times. He eventually settled in a place called Krivoy Rog. It's a pretty big city, over a million people, and nowadays anyway. And he was doing an inheritance through his father's, my grandfather's side, and from England. And anyway, my mother managed to get a hold of him in writing and send him this money, and which was, he was really pretty destitute at the time, judging from his letter. I have the copy of the letter.
So when was that?
It was around 1920, right after 1920, and the communists had already taken over in Russia, and so a $1,500 inheritance was a big chunk of money for him, and he had like eight kids. Yeah, and I was speaking to Eugene Soloviev, you know, that owns the Sitka Rose Gallery, and I said, I wonder if he'd still be alive, and he said, if his descendants would still be alive, and he said, be really highly unlikely, because during the Stalin era, he probably would have got purged, you know. He said, almost anyone that was of any foreign connection got killed, you know. My grandmother had two husbands.
Okay.
She married Richter, then Hanlon.
You know? Oh, okay, so...
Yeah, and when she married Hanlon adopted her two children legally, you see.
He was Richter and then became John Hanlon.
Yep.
So your mother had her brother Fritz, who became John Hanlon, and then her brother William.
And she had a number of brothers and sisters, but many of them died very young, you know, like in infancy. And at the time my grandmother died in 1942, there were only four of her 12 children still living. And it was my mother and two of her sisters and her brother, William Richter Hanlon.
Who were your mother's sisters who survived?
Elizabeth Van Horn and Xenia McGraw.
So that's how you're related to the McGraws?
Yeah, right. Xenia married Don McGraw Sr. I had a lot of first cousins growing up here. I had a number of Hanlon first cousins and the McGraws and the Van Horns. They're all gone now, except three of the McGraws are still living, not in Sitka. Three of Xenia's children.
Your uncle, what did you call him, Bill?
Yeah, or Uncle Bill.
Uncle Bill.
Favorite uncle.
So he was mayor, but was that was that before you were aware, or?
Oh yeah, before I was born, I think. He may have been mayor once in the 40s, I think, but the time he was mayor was in the 20s, I believe. But he was born here in 1879, so he had quite a interesting life for somebody that only left Sitka very few times. He went to Juneau, or he went to Skagway during the gold rush, and didn't get rich. He had a horse there, and he used it to help pack stuff up the trails there, you know, with the miners, and hired his horse for that. But he always talked about the big adventure there. He said he knew Soapy Smith, or knew who he was, at least. You know, I don't think he knew him personally, but and then he was always very interested in mining, prospecting, and stuff. Right up until the end, almost, he was still staking claims. I remember one time he was all crippled up with arthritis in his old age, and he had to walk with two canes, and he wanted to get some ore samples from an island out in Krestoff Sound. And so my brother and I had a little 14-foot Rhinel boat with an inboard in it, and he and my uncle and I took off one morning and went out there, and he had to crawl up on his hands and knees up to this ore outcropping that he knew was there, and then he drilled a hole with a hand steel and a hammer and loaded it with dynamite, and then he crawled back into the boat, and I lit the fuse and went running in the boat, and we went around the corner and waited for the explosion, you know. But it was one of those adventures I had with him growing up, you know. It was in the late 40s. Yeah, it was probably about 1949, right, or 1950, maybe right around then.
Did he stake claims?
He actually had a claim there. It was a stannous fluoride, which is a tin ore. And then he also had tungsten ore claims up in Bear Cove in Silver Bay, and he had some of the underwater claims at Hirschichigoff and things like that, you know. He never made any money off any of his claims, but he sure was active in doing that sort of thing. A lot of the old-timers were, you know, they had that dream of striking it rich, you know. But he started looking into other ores other than just gold, you know. And, probably one of the reasons I studied geology when I went to college was just my association with him. I spent a lot of time over at his house, and I spent a lot of time with him. He would take my brother and I out, and for instance, showed us how to get crabs and how to get, you know, different things, subsistence, where to hunt deer. And he couldn't go in the woods with us, but he'd pick out a mountain and send us up it, you know, when we're pretty young. And one of his adventures he had before my time was he and his son Ike, William Hanlon Jr., everyone called him Ike, they were contracted to catch deer alive to be transplanted to Kodiak, and so they caught a number of deer that way, and the way they did it, they would find an island, that small island that the deer were on, and just, they had this little dog they would send ashore. And the dog would chase the deer into the water, and then they would come along in a skiff and just hobble the deer's legs and throw them in the skiff.
Right.
And they caught quite a few of them that way. I often wondered when he took me out hunting why he'd picked the biggest mountain for me to climb when...
He knew an easier way.
Yeah. Yeah, well... It wasn't legal back then to do it that way, other than with a contract, you know, I guess.
So were all of your mother and her family, they were all Orthodox?
Well, William and Hanlon, all of them were. But when my grandmother married John Hanlon, he was Episcopalian. And so my mother and them belonged to the Episcopal Church. But they were all baptized in the Russian Church, too. So for some reason, he didn't want my mother to go to the Russian school, so she didn't know how to read and write Russian, but she was certainly fluent in speaking it. Fluent, you know. Put it this way, they would all, when my grandmother was living, they would all attend the Russian church with her. But I think just probably because that's what they did when growing up. My mother's best friends were some of the Kashuvarap girls when she was very young, and they were from the Russian, you know, of the Russian church. Their father was a priest, and I couldn't tell you for sure. I don't think that her sisters Xenia and Bessie belonged to the Russian church, but they certainly attended. Even when I was a kid, sometimes we'd go on Russian Easter, and our family would go, you know, and stuff. And we always observed Russian Easter and American Easter and Russian Christmas and American Christmas, you know. Which was kind of neat. You know.
No, there's nothing wrong with celebrating Easter twice and Christmas twice. So, and you were saying that your uncle Bill was a leader in kind of the Orthodox and Tlingit community?
He was, I was kind of surprised when I looked at the enrollment for the Sitka tribe. He was on the original enrollment there, and growing up, I was never told that we were any Native at all. And so that was kind of a surprise to me. And the reason I found out is one of my cousins was trying to enroll in order to get help with her medication. She lived in Tacoma, and she had to enroll with a federally recognized tribe. And I said, well, the Sitka tribe would be the one for you because she's a descendant of him, you know, and so I went on her behalf. I went down and spoke to the tribe, and I said she's a granddaughter of William Richter Hanlon. And they looked and they said, oh, yeah, he's one of the original enrollees, you know, when they first did the tribal roll, I guess. So there was no problem there, you know, getting her enrolled. He was also a guide. He used to take, you know, people out bear hunting and stuff, you know, mainly bear hunting. Did a lot of bear guiding, and he fished commercially. I can remember when he must have been in his 70s, and he had a skiff that he'd keep on the beach at the Crescent, when it still was the Crescent Beach, and he would sometimes decide he was going to go out and visit the Morgans at the head of Silver Bay, so he'd row all the way. And he had a little hand line to, in case he caught a king on the way, he'd put a spoon down there or something, you know. And he'd row to the head of Silver Bay from the Crescent here in the 70s, you know. And then he'd spend the night at the Morgans and then row back the next day.
So the Morgans?
Glenn Morgan and Charlotte Morgan, they were, they had a mine in Silver Bay. They had the Mount Edgecombe Exploration Company or something it was called, I forget, but there's a mine there, you know. And that was, and their house was right at the head of the bay. They had a big house there.
Is that one that's still up there, or?
No, I think
it's
their
gone.
House is long gone.
So they were actively mining, or?
Yeah, well, Morgan would go on trips down south and get people to invest in his mine and sell stocks or something, and they had a stamp mill and everything there on that. As you're going up in the Silver Bay on the right hand side, there used to be the mine. I don't know what's standing now. Probably nothing of it now, but there was the place for processing the ore and stuff. And I asked Morgan. I said, "Did you ever send any ore out?" Well, he said, "We had real high grade ore." But I said, "Did you ever make any money off it?" I don't think so. I don't know. My dad worked there one year Nicholas Haley had found a big boulder that had some gold showing in it, and it was at the end of this long gulch going up to the top of the mountain. So he hired a group of them of miners to go up and drill a mine in that gully. And my dad was one of them. And his, I don't know if you ever heard the name Fred Easley, but Fred Easley was his mucker, they called him. When my dad would blast, then Fred was supposed to go and shovel out the rock that he blasted. And they put a tunnel in there for a ways. It was called the Top of the Hill Claim, but I don't think they ever found anything in there. My dad seemed to think that the glaciers had carried that boulder in there rather than it rolling down from this gulch. You know? And they worked up there to the point that they got snowed in. And so my dad was telling me they made these skis. They took a barrel and broke it apart, you know, and used the staves and then strapped them, made little skis and strapped to their feet to get out of there. And Larry Calvin, my hunting partner, he always questioned my dad. He thought he was making that stuff up just for our benefit, you know. And one time, Larry and my brother, and I wasn't along that trip, several others, they went up Silver Bay, and on the way up to go goat hunting, they came across this pile of skis with the straps on them in the woods there. And I asked Larry just recently, I said, why didn't you bring one of those down? My dad would have been thrilled to death if he had. He says, well, we found them on the way up, he says. And he said, we came down a different route, you know. But it was kind of neat that it proved the story. Yeah. He said they were all neatly piled in one stack right there in the woods. That Top of the Hill Claim was this side of the Lucky Chance Mine. I don't know if you know where that is, but it was before you go over the peaks and down to the Lucky Chance Lakes there. And we used to go up there goat hunting once in a while. Uh-huh. Kind of fun. You know. The cabin was still standing at Lucky Chance Lake back in the 50s, and we would go up there and spend the night in there, you know, to hunt goats and stuff.
So what school did your mother attend?
Well, my grandfather died in, apparently there was a public school here that she went to, but then my grandfather died in 1909, and my grandmother was working for May Mills, the business lady here. She decided that it was too much for my grandmother to try to raise her children. Most of them were already grown up, you know, and her brother Nick was working in the Chichikov mine, and her brother Bill was married with his own family and everything. So it was just her and Xenia. Her sister Bessie was going to nursing school in Seattle, but still she decided it was too much for my grandmother to try to raise those two kids on her own, so she arranged for my mother to go to a school in Ohio, an Episcopal nunnery called the Bethany School for Girls in Glendale, Ohio. And my mother went there, and luckily there were some other girls from Sitka that she knew when she got there. Just, you know, there was a girl named Pearl Robertson that was a lifelong friend of my mother's, and it was quite a coincidence. And then some of the Bart family here, some of their descendants were going there at the time, too, and
in Glendale, Ohio.
Yeah, Glendale, Ohio. And so anyway, she was there for until she was 21, I think. She graduated when she was 18, and then she stayed another couple of years to teach to help pay for her schooling, you know. And she almost became a nun. She said she just decided at the last minute not to take the vows. And so you would be interviewing an empty chair here. If she'd gone through with that one. And then she came back to Sitka. And, for a while she was in Oregon helping her. She went to Oregon and helped her sister, who was having some health problems with tuberculosis. Tuberculosis, as you know, back then was spared no families, I guess, because my mother's sister Annie died when she was about 16. She died in 1908. And just almost in her sister Bessie Elizabeth had spent most of her life with just one lung. She had to have a lung removed, so So anyway, it was tough times back then. And so she went to Oregon, helped her with her young kids. Actually, I was talking to my cousin Fred Van Horn. He said, we thought your mom was our mother when we were growing up, because I guess their mom was in a sanitarium or something, you know.
Well, so she was down there for years.
For a while, yeah, a year or two, a couple of years or so. And then she got badly injured working in a soda fountain. They had those bottles that pressurized bottles for carbonated beverages, and she was carrying it and exploded, and it almost lost her right arm. It took out most of his muscle here. And so she had
that was in Oregon.
Yeah. It was something she had to... She had very little use of her right hand other than a couple of fingers for the rest of her life, really. You know.
And then she came back to Sitka and was... Sitka.
She worked in the hospital down there where the Pioneer Home is there. In the old Pioneer Home, I guess, not the hospital. I guess it was just the Pioneer Home before they built the new one. Worked there for a while, yeah. And then worked for my dad in a liquor store. and then... Married my dad and raised us, you know. My brother was born in 1934, and I was born in 19...
So that would have been the Anchor Bar liquor store?
Yeah. And, of course, I grew up in the house there, the family house that I was born in, where the Sitka Rose Gallery is. My brother and I were both born in there, and so was my Aunt Xenia. My mother and her other sibling were born in the old house, which is where the Bayview Trading Post is now.
So basically next door.
Yeah, they had a big log house there. That's where Richter's Bakery was at one time.
So they sold that for the hotel?
Yeah, and of course the creek came down between Lake Street and Pestra Street. There was houses on both sides of the creek from Swan Lake. And that was kind of a neat play area, and salmon used to go up that stream too, you know, into the lake. And
what kind of salmon?
Sockeyes, humpies, dogs, and cohos. Yeah.
Wow.
And that was all wiped out when they did the urban renewal.
So it's such a tiny lake.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Even I started working for the government in 1961, and cohos used to still, that was before the urban renewal, they still come all the way up to the observatory there, you know, to spawn. And Jim Parker said he begged the city when they did that to put lights in there and riffles in that culvert to keep those runs going, but they didn't, I guess. But I can remember as a kid skating on the lake and seeing chum salmon swimming around under the ice, you know, while I was, you know, when the ice was clear.
So the coho would swim up to the observatory?
Yeah, Wrinkle Neck Creek, that little creek. They'd come all the way up there. Yep. In that little creek. Yeah, that creek is dammed off up at the observatory with a culvert, and they did that when they had the experimental farm there, so they had water for their horses, they said, in Renamount. And coals would come as far as that culvert. They'd actually jump at the culvert there, but couldn't make it into it.
Where was the elementary school?
When I went to school, it was all in where the Pacific High is now. There was a two-story building there. When my uncle was mayor, he had that built. And it housed grade school right through high school. And so I went there through the seventh grade, and then they built Etland Street School. And that housed the eighth grade through the senior. I was telling my grandson, we didn't have buses in those days. I had to walk all the way to school, half a block.
So when your grandmother, is she the one in the photo that's in front of the Sitka Rose?
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. You know, she didn't even read and write. She always signed everything with an X, and I always wondered why. And my mother couldn't answer that, because it seemed like all her brothers and sisters wrote, and I seen it in Russian and English, both, you know. I think it just, she wasn't sent to school like they were. She went to, I think they went to school in California, and she went down there and worked in a cigar factory, came back addicted to cheroots, which was a little cigar, smoked them the rest of her life, and married when she was only 16, you know. That's the only reason I can think of why she never...
Just didn't have a chance to go to school.
Apparently not.
So didn't they have a Orthodox, Russian Orthodox school here?
Yeah.
In those years, but...
Yeah, they did. That's a puzzlement. I don't know why she, you know, completely neglect her education like that.
Mm-hmm. So
her brothers and sisters clearly wrote... some of the photographs we have were written on by her, you know, older sister. And the guy that built the house where the Sitka Rose Gallery is, his name was... Sharigan. Older spelling was Shargan, but then it got Americanized into Sharigan. But he wrote Russian, and his wife also could, write the Russian language and stuff. And his wife was my grandmother's sister, and her name was Luba. And I'd never heard the expression until later when I read some of Bob DeArmond's things. They called that area where we lived Russian Town. You know, and when I think about it, most of the people around there, our neighbors and stuff, were, they had their names ended in off, you know, OFF, you know, and that was pretty much Russian ancestry. There were a lot of them around, you know.
But not now.
Not now.
And then going back to, you know, like one of the things you were telling me about, the Elks and the Moose, like the different clubs... Didn't allow natives?
Native membership until I don't know what year, but I know I was playing with the A and B, and this was back before I knew I was any native, and I played with them in 1957, the first year. And I can remember walking with some of my teammates in Juneau, and Vern Metcalf, very well-known radio man over there in Juneau, invited us into the Moose Club, and the bartender got really mad at him for doing that because he wouldn't serve my teammates. And at the time, I belonged to the Moose here in Sitka. And so did my mother and her sisters. One of her sisters went through almost all the chairs, you know. But actually, technically, they shouldn't have even been allowed to belong because there was a no-native policy then, you know.
So, and that was in, like, the late 50s?
It was still into the 60s. I got married in 1963, and I dropped my membership because my wife was Native, and Dave Gangle told me, he said, oh, you don't have to drop because you can still belong. They may change the rule. If you're married to a Native woman, you can belong. And I said, well, can my children belong? And he said, well, no. And I said, well, then I don't belong, you know, so... But that was as late as 1963, so I don't know when they changed the policy there. I'm not trying to badmouth them or anything.
No,
you know.
No.
It was a policy that was in effect then. You know.
Do you remember what you thought about that at the time?
I never gave it a lot of thought. When I was growing up, the next-door neighbors there, my best friend was, his dad was Ben Diedrichson, and he went by the name Butch Burke, but he was like a brother almost. He'd spend nights at my house, I'd spend nights at his house and stuff, and never gave much thought. And when they closed the government school down there in the village, all the kids there came up to the school I was going to, and there were already natives in there. Bunny Donnelly was a classmate of mine from the first grade through the graduation, you know. Jake Peters was there and a few others, but then a whole bunch came up all at once, and I never even gave it a second thought that I can remember. It was, seemed like there wasn't any prejudice amongst the kids, but I remember when we'd go to the theater, all the old-time natives would sit on one side of the theater, and then, you know, I don't think they had to. Maybe they did earlier on or something, but it's just a policy they adhered to, I guess.
So this would be older people.
Yeah, the
but
older
the
people.
Kids would
but
sit
kids
wherever.
And they go right around, yeah.
And that's like 50s.
Yeah. Yeah, 40s and 50s, yeah.
I think you were telling me about how Harold Donnelly did belong to the Elks, but you're saying that might have been an exception because he was such a great athlete.
Great athlete. I was just at Bunny's mom's funeral just recently, and he told how they when they got their property where their house is on Edland Street that they were told they couldn't buy it. And Harold went and talked to Tom Tilson, and Tom Tilson said, I'll take care of this. And he took care of it, so they were able to buy the property. So there was definitely some prejudice back then. I don't know what year that was.
So, and Tom Tilson was a businessman?
He was a local merchant. He owned Sitka Mercantile, and he had come here from Norway like when he was 1 year old, his family moved here, and he was fluent in Tlingit, I would imagine, because he played with the Tlingit kids, and so the native people just loved him because they'd go in there and speak Tlingit to him just like one of their own. And I've talked to some like Al Gray, and they said, yeah, he had no accent or anything. He spoke just like us, you know. And so did the Haleys, Charlie Haley and Tom Haley. They could speak Tlingit fluently without any accent. And they came here as children, you know. So I'm sure, I never asked them, but I'm sure that they picked it up just playing with their playmates, you know. Right, because there were a lot of Tlingit speakers around then, you know, a lot of native children.
So the Haleys you mentioned, those were people who were older when you were a kid?
Yeah, there were two brothers, Tom Haley and Charlie Haley, and they were descendants of Nicholas Haley that discovered gold in Silver Bay, and then he got killed by a bear at some point. He got mauled and died from the mauling, but Charlie and Tom were very good friends of our family, and when I got old enough to hunt and successfully bring in deer and stuff, Tom always wanted, if it was a nice buck or something, he wanted the head because he made head cheese, is what he said. But he was just a nice old man that I knew. He and his brother Charlie were both interpreters, translators, when they needed Tlingit translators, you know. Bob DeArmond never had much good to say about my uncle. I think possibly his father ran against him for the mayor thing or something, may have had some reason, I don't know. But
so opposing factions.
Yeah, opposing factions. You could talk a little bit about growing up there on the Crescent. It was a neat place to grow up with the large Crescent beach there. And the when I was very young, it was Sand Beach. And then what happened during the war, they started, and maybe even before the war, they started taking steam shovels down there and digging sand and gravel for construction.
Oh.
And then they'd leave these big holes, and then eventually all the sand shifted into those holes. And so it became a rocky beach rather than a sand beach. And then with the Columbia Lumber Company there, which was a large, large sawmill, it's extended way out to where the Centennial Building is from Lincoln Street, you know, and that's all been filled in. But anyway, that was a neat place to play around and under, and there was always wood available. They had the incinerator there where they burn all their scrap wood, and we were allowed to go and take it as we wanted. And some of the wood that we used to take was better than what they sell in the stores nowadays, but it was culled back then. And we'd use it to build rafts and camps and forts. And this was in the days before TV and video games and all this stuff, you know, so
paradise.
Kept us occupied, yeah. I know one of my uncles told my mom, he says, you don't have to ever worry about looking for Willis when it's supper time or something. You know he's going to be down on the beach, and that's where I hung out, you know.
I remember growing up before the sewage treatment plant, and there was, you know, disgusting things on the beach. And then, so what was that like with
that? All the houses had their sewer lines go down on the beach there, but didn't stop us from swimming there when we were kids. I guess maybe that's why my immunity is so good, to swimming in raw sewage or something. But
so how far did the outfalls, did most of them go into deep
way
water?
Out. They went way out, but no, at low tide they were exposed, you know, the ends of them. And, it was, thinking back on it, it wasn't the healthiest place to play, I guess, but it was neat, you know. From Sheldon Jackson to the sawmill was kind of my territory there, you know. I let Martin Strand and his gang have the Indian River mouth there. That was their area, and our area was the Crescent there. And just to get around to Wake Anderson's there, you had to paddle, you know, where the Anderson store is, you had to paddle all the way around the outside of the sawmill. And they had booms out there with logs way out, you know. And so we'd build these rafts, and we'd go all the way out around there and come onto the beach behind the Anderson store. And those stores downtown, people don't realize, but that Harbor Drive has all been filled in. Those stores were sitting on pilings back then, you know, like Ernie's Bar. And one of my playmates when I was a kid, Albert Brookman, and I, we had a little camp under Ernie's Bar where we stashed all of our goodies, I guess, that you're not supposed to have and stuff, you know. And we came there one day, and there had been a big high tide, and everything had washed out.
So what were your treasures, your stash?
Pipes, stuff like that, you know. Just silly stuff, you know. I always say I never smoked, I guess. But we used to smoke pipes back then when we could get the tobacco to put in them and stuff. But I never got the habit of smoking, put it that way. Okay. And then there was a guy named Herbie Oya. His family is what? Oja Street, O-J-A. We always pronounce it Oya. But anyway, he saved my life when I was a kid. I would have drowned if it hadn't been for him. My brother had made a little raft, and I was playing on a crescent, and the tide was in, and I was pulling along, and I went over the edge of one of the drop-offs I mentioned where the steam shovels had dug, and they were about 10 feet deep. And I went over the edge of that and went to push off the bottom, and there was no bottom there, and I fell off the raft and let go of the pole, and I was wearing hip boots. My dad had bought me this pair of hip boots, and I'd go clear to the bottom of that hole, you know, and I can still picture there was little bullheads, just hundreds of them swimming all around me down there, and then I'd get to the surface and yell and stick my hand up, and then down I'd go again, and my brother and Butch Burke were there, but neither of them knew how to swim, and so Herbie Oya was up on the beach further, and he saw what was going on, so he came out and saved me. He swam out and saved me, and so my dad gave him a reward for rescuing me. Then he paid him to teach me and Ed and Butch how to swim. Yeah.
Well, so where did you learn how to swim?
Just down there in the bay, just down in the crescent. Yeah. He taught us how to dog paddle, but that was good enough, you know. At least you didn't go down. You went horizontally. Of course, we had the ballpark there, you know, where the playground is now. Was a big grandstand there and stuff. That was quite a play area for us when we were kids. But I spent most of my time behind the grandstand because they'd pay us 10 cents a foul ball, if we, you know, and so there was a whole group of us kids would be behind the grandstand. When the ball would come over, we'd go piling onto it, you know. It was sort of a free-for-all to try to get the ball, but it was fun.
So the grandstands were where the playground is now?
Yeah, right behind the Russian bishop's house there. Early on, the gym wasn't there, like Gil mentioned, but then the ball field became smaller as they built the gym and stuff there, you know.
So they built the gym in right field.
Edwards Street gym, yeah, in right field. I remember one incident we had when it just seemed like we're always doing something, you know, and one time under the grandstand there, all the water from the ball field would trickle down under there in little rivulets or whatever you'd call them, you know. And so one time we got the bright idea to try to dam it up under there. And there was a bunch of us, and we started just using dirt to dam this water. And pretty soon we had almost the whole size of the underneath the grandstand, like a little lake under there, and probably a foot or more deep, you know. And then finally it just gave out. It broke through in one place, and the whole works went and it was just like a waterfall going down into the Russian bishop's house. And the Russian bishop was pretty angry at us because here's a whole flood of water comes down there all at once, you know. But I don't think it did any lasting harm. But
or that building was probably in pretty rough shape at that point.
It was bad, yeah.
Wouldn't take much.
Yeah. Yeah. My grandmother used to cook in there when she was, you know, back in the 1800s there. She was a cook for the students there and the priests, I guess. And right up until the time she died, she was still making their holy bread, they'd call it, for their communion. I think it was an unleavened bread or something that she would make.
So your grandmother always went to the Orthodox church?
Yeah. And then her and my grandfather were married in that chapel in that Russian orphanage in 1887. I would assume they were married there rather than the cathedral because he wasn't Russian Orthodox, I guess. I don't know.
That was her second husband?
Her second husband, yeah. I have no idea where the first one and her got married at.
But she was quite young, her first marriage.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Amongst his things when he died, that she acquired was a deed of trust, which was for all the land where Sheldon Jackson is there. I asked your aunt, Dee Longenbaum, one time about it, and I said, well, how could... I looked at the city offices. The deed was actually recorded there, and there were two fellows named... One was Imhoff, and the other was Dern, and they put in a homestead claim for 160 acres each.
At Sheldon Jackson.
Where the Sheldon Jackson School is now, in something like 1880. And anyway, he lent them money in 1882 or something, and they gave him this deed of trust where if they didn't pay it, he would get the property and the brewery. They were going to build a brewery there. And they had built a building, apparently. And so I asked Dee, well, how come that wasn't valid? And she said, because it was before the Homestead Act went into effect. I said, well, it's recorded. She said, well, a lot of people did that, you know. And apparently Brady's, I don't know how Brady's got the land but for the Sheldon Jackson School. And it's all recorded. Their claims are recorded down there, too, each of their individual Imhoff and Durham that he lent the money to, that Richter lent the money to.
So he loaned them money to
for their brewery, and then with the stipulation, they gave him a deed of trust if they didn't pay it. Now, a deed of trust is only good for like 10 years or something like that. So I have an old copy of that deed of trust, you know. But apparently my mother said one of her brother Nick, just resented the Brady's over that. He figured that was his mother's property, should have been, you know, and... Yeah, I don't know what they would have done with all that land, but.
So was it the same layout as the SJ property or overlapping?
I think it's pretty much the same layout. It was 320 acres, and I think that's about the size of the Sheldon Jackson property. But the story is that when they tore down the brewery, they brought it and dumped it in their yard there, and part of the house where the Sitka Rose Gallery is built out of that. Probably the yellow cedar sheathing that they found on there was from that old brewery building.
So they actually built a brewery on that land?
They had a brewery building there. I don't think they ever made beer, but I think they, yeah. There were several breweries here in town, attempted breweries at least. Uh-huh. The Cohens, I think, actually made beer, didn't they? There was the Cohen family had a brewery.
So Imhoff and Durham actually built a building for a brewery where Sheldon Jackson campus is now?
Yeah, somewhere there. Yeah.
And then they ended up not having a valid claim on that land?
Well, I don't know. I think they just ran out of money. I don't know. I really couldn't tell you that.
If he still had that deed of trust, he probably never got his money back.
No.
Well, so was Richter a brewer, or what was his trade?
No, he was a baker. He had a bakery.
Oh, that's...
But he had other... I don't know. He was into buying and selling property and stuff fairly early on after the... You know, where the Bayview Trading Post is now, that's where our family house was. And at the time of the transfer, the deed for that property was owned by a guy named Kuzma Tarantyov. And he was a Creole that had been trained to do engravings for map making. And he was the one that did the engravings for the Tebenkoff maps that were widely used, I guess, in the early days. And anyway, that was his property, and the Maksudov signed an indenture testifying that this is the property of this Kuzma Tarantyov. And then the day, and this was signed on the day of the transfer ceremony, October 18th, 1867. The next day, he sold the property to a guy named McGuire or something, and then McGuire eventually sold it to Richter. So, and that's how it came into our family.
And you still have that original deed from the Prince Maksudov?
I have the indenture. Yeah, and it's witnessed by Rousseau and Pestroff.
Neat. Yeah. This has been an interview with Willis Osbakken, recorded in November of 2012 at the studios of Raven Radio, Sitka, Alaska.